Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome back to the Salyer Report a man who really needs no introduction here. His name is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He served with great distinction in the military, both line military and administrative, and then in the Bush administration as Chief of Staff to Colin Powell as Secretary of State. So he certainly knows the U.S. State Department well, and then is now a professor of government and public policy at the College of William and Mary, and has spoken very forthrightly for many years on what is happening with the national security state. Before I bring him on, I just want to say he made the most prescient comments during the campaign. He described the extent to which the entire U.S. economy, global economy, is dependent on the U.S. national security state and the war machine. And the question was, could any candidate make a difference? And I must have to say, watching what's happening, he was extremely prescient in his comments. So, Colonel Wilkerson, welcome back to the Salyer Report.
Good to be back with you, Catherine.
So we've had tremendous number of personnel changes, and I would love to just step through them and talk with you about what your impressions are. We see Tillerson leaving yesterday, the State Department having essentially been fired the week before, and we see Pompeo from the CIA nominated to be the new Secretary of State. And now Bolton coming in as National Security Advisor McMaster out after much rumors about that happening. What does this augur for both the CIA and State Department? What do these changes mean?
I said earlier in the Trump administration's first year that when we started seeing sane and sober people leave the administration, we should grow even more concerned. I think that's true, and I think the people who are coming in should deepen our concern. That said, I think what we're seeing is, if I'm judging this individual correctly, and by this individual, I mean President Trump, and we have debated this in seminar after seminar at William & Mary, if we're judging him rightly, he is one of the most brutish, brutal, arrogant, narcissistic egomaniacs ever to occupy the White House. So what we're viewing, probably, if that's our interpretation of this individual, we're viewing him doing a number of things here with this personnel perturbation and turmoil. One, he's attempting to keep his base titillated. And in that respect, he's doing a grand job because he's got everyone from MSNBC, even some commentators on Fox, lapping up the things that he's putting out there. And that's just fulfilling everything he desires, which is to bash the U.S. media constantly and consistently, no matter who they are, with a little bit of preference for Fox, of course. The second thing he's doing is trying to get Stormy Daniels and the other array of women who are now after him full force, and of course the Russia scandal and Bob Mueller and others associated with it, off the TV screens, and keep the TV screens full of these other personnel changes and so forth, which the media, as they did during his campaign, is accommodating him with their own acquiescence in this. He's playing them as Anne Sophie Mutter plays the violin, and they're more or less helping him in this process. So I'm not quite as concerned as I might be by the likes of John Bolton coming into the administration, because I see Trump and Bolton is so similar in their brutish arrogance, and I know John Bolton very intimately, that very soon John Bolton will be without any listeners in the White House, to include the president. The only way the National Security Advisor has any influence on anything is if he has the president's ear, and he has it almost equal to or more than anyone else, like a Kissinger, a Brzezinski, or even a mild-mannered Brent Scowcroft. John Bolton is not going to have this president's ear very long, because this president is not going to want John Bolton's competition. So I'm not quite as worried about Bolton being there as I might be someone else who would be able to manipulate staff and so forth underneath Trump. It is a sad situation that we have the array of characters that we have.
Right. And I think that also the way the Tillerson firing was handled is enough to chill any thinking person from going to work in this administration. There's no doubt about that.
That's Donald Trump.
Yeah.
This is quintessential Donald Trump.
Although, I have to say that I started off the 2016 campaign having spent 11 years in New York just infuriated that anybody would seriously consider voting for Donald Trump. But the reality is, the reason we have Trump is the American establishment thought that Clinton was an alternative. And for the life of me, I cannot understand whether it was the Bushes or the Clintons trying to push the same on. So I really blame the establishment for ending up with Trump. I voted for Trump, and because I'm, a lot for many, many years I've written in a candidate, but I finally voted for Trump because the idea of another 4 or 8 years of Clinton was unacceptable. And the person who persuaded me was Michael Moore. I don't know if you ever heard his presentation, but he said voting for Donald Trump would be the biggest FU in the history of Western civilization. And the feeling really was in the heartland, if you can't fix it, you might as well break it. So now what we're watching, unfortunately, is the break it.
I think a lot of people in that sort of 10 to 20% middle ground, many of them
Right.
independents, some of them disenchanted Democrats, some disenchanted Republicans did the same thing. And I don't discount the value of, quote, breaking it, unquote. I would never have voted for Hillary Clinton. I thought she was a warmonger par excellence.
Right.
And I hate to say this, but being a woman and being the first female president, I thought she would think she had to prove her cojones, if you will, right off the bat. And so we would have found ourselves in a war really quickly, one of her choosing and picking. And that didn't appeal to me at all. I don't think we had any choice in 2016, except perhaps as you just defined it. Let's break it and
Right.
see what happens. I think we're along a path right now that may very well do that. I'm just not certain we have the skill, the talent, and the institutional architecture remaining to fix it. And so I'm very worried about it being broken and staying broken for a long time.
Right. Well, I saw one presentation you gave that was quite brilliant, but you talked about how many fronts you could fight a war on, and I was very much reminded of Jorn Keenan's statement that it's the ultimate privilege of the man who believes the world is his enemy to prove himself right. But right now it looks like we're picking a fight with Russia, China, North Korea, Syria, and Iran, among others, and alienating all of our allies. How do you win a war on this many fronts?
You don't. We are violating the first precept of international relations. It's called conservation of enemies, and it simply means you don't want to have any more enemies at any one time than you can handle. That's a very dangerous precept to violate, and as I said, we're just doing it profoundly. At the same time, I don't believe this president or the group around him, even supplementing the present idiocy with Mike Pompeo, Gina Haspel, potentially the bloody Gina, the torture master of the secret prison in Thailand, John Bolton, and so forth, is going to do anything that Donald Trump doesn't want to do in his heart of hearts, wherever that is. And so I'm a little bit encouraged by the fact that I don't think he is at root a warmonger. Not for a moment do I think he wouldn't hesitate to start a little war somewhere in order to continue to get some of these other issues off the TV screen. But I
Right.
don't believe he's fundamentally a warmonger. And so it's going to be very interesting to see, for example, the clash of personalities that's going to occur now, because I know John Bolton is probably one of the living, breathing, most warmongery people on the face of this earth. I've sat in an office with John Bolton and had him tell me how we ought to attack the North Korea, the DPRK, and have him go on about how they are hollow, they'll collapse in a minute, all we need to do is bomb them, they'll fall apart, and so forth. And my response, being from both a military professional perspective as well as a diplomatic perspective at the time, because he was Undersecretary at the State Department at the time, was to say, John, You don't understand war. There'll be 100,000 casualties, many of them American. There are over 200,000 Americans living in the Seoul area alone. There'll be all these casualties. We'll win, but it'll be a Pyrrhic victory, John, and it's not necessary. And John looking at me and saying, well, you do the military things, I don't. That's John Bolton. Let's send all these young men and women out there to die for John Bolton.
Well, you know, it's funny. I worked with, I've never worked with Bolton, but I worked with people like him in the Bush administration. You know, and they've got a two-track mind. They can't fathom a 26-track world, and they're just immune to being able to feel or understand or intellectualize the real consequences. It's almost, it's like they're living in a video game.
You're absolutely right. I used to recoil when people would say derisive things about Bolton, or perhaps more balanced things about him, and then whether they were derisive or balanced, they would say at the end, inevitably, but he's a really brilliant man. I'd look at him and say, where is that brilliance? He's a dumb man. That's all I could detect.
Well, sometimes if you're in the position of something like the president, you love people who make it simple. But of course, you know, it's never going to work in the real world. Well, we've seen two speeches, a much more detailed one from Putin in his presidential address. I think it was a week or two before the election, laying out the developments of weapons in Russia. And then we see Trump give a speech to the military in San Diego, implying that we have these miraculous, mysterious weapons that he can't talk about. And so from both Russia and America, you see posturing about their new, incredible, fantastic weapons. Putin obviously putting a lot more meat on the bone than Trump. What is all this promise of mysterious, magical weapons, and what does it mean?
There are motivations on both sides that are so long in terms of the history of their development and so forth that I won't go into them. But suffice to say right now that what's happening, I think, is both of these leaders drawing some sort of political strength from the posture they take towards one another. And Trump's is the most convoluted here because of the so-called, quote, Russia scandal, unquote, are maintaining their domestic positions politically by what they do to one another or what they say about one another. And what that's doing, and here's the scary thing about it, what it's doing is causing, for example, Prime Minister Abe to decide that the United States is no longer trustworthy. He's not about to turn to Russia. And so what he's doing is rapidly destroying everything that we did with regard to post-war Japan. In other words, he is going to create a full-up, fully armed, selling its arms on the world market, submarines, fighter planes, ships, and so forth, fully nuclear Japan. And he's going to go his own way. That is going to start a race in Northeast Asia, one of the still most dangerous regions of the world, with China and Japan, possibly a reunified Korea, that we're going to regret having started. China is already looking at discarding Mao Zedong's philosophy that nuclear weapons were really worthless because no one would ever use them, and all China needed was a few in order to deter any crazy states' use against China. They're already discarding that and discussing in the Politburo how they ought to be a full-up nuclear state, that is, all kinds of nuclear weapons on submarines, in bombs, in missiles, and so forth. And they ought to even be able to ride out a first strike and to strike back. This means a far more robust nuclear arsenal in China. Japan will match that. China will then match that, and so forth and so on. We're looking at a massive arms race starting in the world with the world's most dangerous weapons at a time when we should be continuing the path post-Cold War of bringing those weapons as close to zero as we can. This is very dangerous.
Well, and it was really the second Bush administration that started and the neocons that started waving around the idea that we could pull off a first strike. I mean, clearly Putin's address was meant to deter the notion that we could pull off a first strike.
It's always been discussed in the more elitist circles of nuclear scholarship and what I would call nuclear weapons use It goes all the way back to the very beginning when Eisenhower wanted the Atoms for Peace program and really wanted everyone to be able to share in atomic energy without the weapons dangers associated with it. There's always been this element on the other side of the road, so to speak, that fought this idea and wanted to use nuclear weapons to reinforce even more powerfully American hegemony in the world. You're right. They're back, and they're back with a vengeance, and they're talking about things like first use of nuclear weapons. And you find this astonishing hearing with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee a few months ago, where that senator from Idaho, Senator Risch, essentially stands up and states that the Constitution of the United States is an anachronism, and that with regard to nuclear weapons, of course, the president should have the right to push the button. And should have the right to push the button first, only consulting those immediately around him at the time, giving an instantaneous nature to nuclear obliteration. This is Risch of Idaho, a Republican senator, saying the Constitution, with regard to the war power and where that war power should belong in the Congress, is an anachronism. So Trump's got support out there.
That's, every day I see a new ridiculous concept on why we need to change the Constitution. Cynthia McKinney just got a mailing from some group of women getting together to reinvent the Constitution to include feminine concepts. And you just, it's funny, but it's not funny. And what you realize is that the people who would love to tear up the Constitution are looking for any angle that will get them in. I think people are so, the general population is so ignorant of what the world would be like if we didn't have the Constitution that they just, they're in the process of committing political suicide by supporting these notions. I thought of you very much the other day when I watched testimony from a Marine General Neller, who said that their biggest obstacle in recruitment was that 70% of young Americans do not qualify for recruitment for moral, emotional, or physical reasons.
This is true. What you have about every year is 4.5 million or so Americans, now male and female, passing through what I would call the selective service vulnerability period. Of that 4.5 million, fully one third is too obese to serve in the armed forces, and another third is intellectually incapable of passing the armed forces qualification test. So you only have a third of that 4.5 million that is vulnerable to being recruited for our all-volunteer force, and you can discount them automatically, the graduates of Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Cornell, and so forth. So what you've got now is you've got, for example, 40% of the United States Army coming from seven states, and you can name all those states.
Right. I live in one.
Yeah, you got recruiting in Alabama, for example, which
Right.
produces more recruits every year than New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles combined. Alabama's got about 4.5 million people. Those city areas have about 30 million in aggregate. So you see what's happening to the demography of the armed forces. We're having symposia all across the country. We've had one at Kansas, one at Women Mary. We're having one at Ohio this month on the 29th, and we're going to have one at Stanford next year. And we're looking at the all-volunteer force and how it is falling apart around the very precepts on which it was created. We have the poorest people in America bleeding and dying for the other people in America, less than 1%, bleeding and dying for the other 99 plus percent. It is untenable, it is immoral, it is unethical, and most powerfully of all, it seems, it is also physically unsustainable.
Right.
The Army paid last year $455 million in bribes just to meet its recruitment goals.
Right. That's, well, I live in the heartland and I moved to Tennessee in 2000, and what I've watched is a steady deterioration in the health of the general population and the young people, and it's very clear what's causing it. And I've never been able to understand what the plan is. And when I read Mattis's and Trump's new national security plan, they're describing something that requires human personnel. And I'm watching, the government policies that are intentionally producing a population that is very unhealthy And I can't, you know, there's a disconnect between what we're doing to produce an unhealthy population and the plans they're making for human personnel. I don't get it. I don't get the disconnect.
I don't get it either. And the Department of Defense is going to spend, if the Congress approves these programs, because they are very, very intrusive programs, lots of money in order to go into the high schools, middle schools, junior highs, and even elementaries across the country and do things like try to improve nutrition. Now, I don't, as a citizen, have a problem with DOD spending money that way. But I do have a problem with what signal that sends. One, only DOD is competent to do this. It's saying the rest of the government is so dysfunctional, it can't do it, because we have cabinet departments and agencies that should be looking over these things and spending their money to do them. The second thing it alarms me about is we're militarizing this country in such significant ways that I would not be
Right.
surprised at all to wake up one morning and find a four-star general standing in the Oval Office over the prostrate body of Donald J. Trump, for example.
Well, you can understand why they must be very frustrated.
Yes.
You
One recruiter told me
know.
recently, he had just left the largest recruiting district in the United States, at that time headquartered in Little Rock, Arkansas. And he said, "I'll tell you why we don't go to Harvard or Princeton or Cornell or any of those places. It's not because we couldn't maybe get a recruit here or a recruit there, but it's not easy. It's extremely difficult. We go to places like Selma, Alabama, because there it's simple." That young man who walks out and sees that contract that the Army recruiter hands him with a $40,000 bonus for putting his signature on the
Right.
paper, that's the most money he's ever seen or probably thinks he'll ever see in his life at one time.
Right. Well, what I see in Tennessee is families who are over the barrel, and the son or daughter signs up to help, whether it's the student loans or the family credit card debt. They're basically helping their family get out of a predatory machinery, you know, by going into the military. And that predatory machinery is, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the government's get them in debt so that, you know, they will go in the machinery. It's a very, you know, snake and snake potion system on the ground when you look at it. Okay, so one of the biggest problems we have politically in this country and have for a long time, and I think you are one of the most eloquent explainers of that problem, is Israel. So Israel has been a very big problem. It's certainly, now that we've spent trillions in war and gotten bogged ourselves bogged down in the Middle East, thanks to Israel and the Zionists and the neocons, Israel seems to be ever more ascendant. You know, sometimes I wonder if the people who got Donald Trump elected, forget Russia, the interference in the election was the Israeli intelligence. So I'm going to post one of your recent speeches about this with the commentary for the Salir Report, because it's a complex problem. But what do you see Israel as having more power in this administration? I think one of the reason people voted for Donald Trump was they were very afraid of how much power they'd have in a Clinton administration. But it really looks like all this did was, by voting for Trump, you delayed the effect for about 3 months, and we're back to the same Israel-dominated plan in the Middle East.
I'll tell you how the Israelis look at it, at least from the point of view of Haaretz, which is one of the few newspapers left in Israel that isn't bought by Sheldon Adelson for Bibi Netanyahu and his propaganda. They think, the editorial staff, Gideon Levy in particular, think that the only place Donald Trump has unanimity of opinion that's favorable is in Tel Aviv, and the only place Bibi Netanyahu does is in Washington. That sort of
Right.
explains the dilemma. We are as close to Israel as we have ever been in the dangerous ways that closeness might rebound to our disinterest, one of which is we just raised the first flag over a U.S. base in Israel since 1948. Now, that means that when something happens, whether it's Hezbollah raining missiles on Israel or maybe even the IRGC or the Quds Force infiltrating and doing something inside Israel proper, or maybe the occupied territories, the West Bank, or whatever, that we will be able to say we were impacted. And you don't have to think very long about what that'll mean in terms of our coming to Israel's defense. We have been attacked because the Stars and Stripes were flying over this little Air Force base we've created in Israel. So the relationship is as one-sided as it's ever been. And Avigdor Lieberman, the defense minister of Israel, who has on the floor of the Knesset called duly elected members of the Knesset who happen to be Arab war criminals, is giving a speech at the Jerusalem Post conference in New York in April. And the title of that speech is, quote, "The Coming War with Iran," unquote. So that's where we're headed.
Well, Tillerson and Mattis talked Trump out of canceling or trying to cancel the Iran deal. So Tillerson clearly was not on board for war with Iran. And with Tillerson out and Pompeo over at State and Bolton in, I'm assuming where this is headed is war with Iran. And my assessment, I have no expertise in this area, is that's a war we're going to lose.
It's a war that's going to be an interminable war, just like the one in Iraq was, even more so probably. Iran is four times bigger than Iraq. It's 75 million people, not 27 million people. It's not a bunch of sects and different groups who don't even recognize themselves first as Iraqis, which Iraq was. It's a group of 75 million people who fundamentally recognize themselves either as Persians, that's about 52%, or as beholden in some way to the Persians and to the 5,000-year history of Persia and to Tehran. This is not going to be a country that falls apart when we attack it. It's going to be a country that unifies itself in a major way. We're going to have to put 500,000-plus troops on the ground. We'll have to go back to the draft, of course, in order to create that size of force. And we're going to have to go all over the country, take 10 years, spend $2 to $3 trillion. And during that time, we're going to have a red bullseye on the back of every Marine, every soldier, every American in the region, because every Arab, every Muslim in the region, and probably some from outside, will unite and attack us in a guerrilla war. If we think Iraq was bad, hold on to your horses. Iran will be 10 times worse.
So why do this? I mean, it's grand stupidity on a, you know, what Israel's saying is to get our way, we're willing to destroy America.
I think what Israel's strategy here is that they want to keep the Arab countries, Syria is a perfect case in point right now, so at their own throats, as it were, so involved in internecine struggle that they cannot unify in any way as a single state or as a combination of states and bring some power to bear on Israel. That's their strategy. This is an I don't think Israel wants a massive war with any of these states in collection or individually. It wants the United States to bash them, to bomb them, for example, and to keep them at each other's throats, and thinks that it can manage that kind of a very difficult, complex strategy over time. I think what Israel is doing right now, the Netanyahu leadership in particular, is sealing the doom of the state of Israel. I would not be at all surprised if within the few years I have left on this earth, Israel ceases to exist. If it doesn't cease to exist, if it doesn't cease, then what it will become is an apartheid state, increasingly isolated on the world scene, and look a lot like South Africa in a decade or so, with the world condemning it. And this BDS movement, for example, will spread and deepen. Everyone will boycott Israel. Everyone will sanction Israel. Everyone will disinvest from any Israeli-connected investment, and it will shrivel up and die. It already has apartheid in the West Bank. It already has apartheid in Gaza. It already has apartheid in largely in Jerusalem. You could, as Carter intimated in his book, former President Carter, call it an apartheid state today. It is certainly not a democracy as long as it maintains the brutal occupation it does and maintains control over the Golan, which is not its territory, then it is not a democracy. So we're seeing a development in the Middle East that we never anticipated in 1948, except on the Joint Staff. You would be surprised to read the Joint Staff's recommendation to Truman They were unanimous in telling President Truman he shouldn't recognize Israel in 48 and in telling him why. And the why was very prescient. It more or less forecasted what's happening today. You would be sitting in a country of 5 to 7 million, and you would have 400 million around you who wanted to kill you.
I was at a conference about 15 years ago, and some professor sat down who was a complete stranger, who proceeded to explain to me that the Vatican's goal in the Middle East was to end up controlling Jerusalem, and the way they were going to do that was to let Israel do whatever they want, and Israel would proceed to commit suicide and do exactly what they've done, and when it was all over, the state of Israel would not exist. And I thought the guy was completely nuts. And just excused myself. But these days I think back to that and I wonder if he really knew something.
Yeah, I've had a number of people from the region actually sort of talk that way. I even had, when Powell was visiting with Arafat in Ramallah, I had one of the heads of the Christian church in, I believe his location was Jerusalem at the time, who looked across the table and said to me, you know, the biggest threat that I have and the biggest threat that my Christian flock has in this region is not the Arabs, not Islam, not the Muslims. The biggest threat is Israel, which was sort of counterintuitive, but I
Right.
understood what he meant.
Right. So let's talk money for a second, and I know that's not your area, but it certainly looks like the national security state, which has become progressively more and more expensive and progressively less and less economic and able to kind of produce enough value to cover itself. Every year, it just gets hungrier and hungrier. It's kind of like a tapeworm that's growing bigger and bigger and killing the host. And it cannot conceive of a way to one get back into any kind of an economic structure or stop eating its host. Why has the national security state literally become out of control in its financial and political demands?
I think there are a number of reasons. As you said, I'm not an economist, but I've read Piketty religiously. I've read a number of Nobel Prize winning economists' books and papers. And you know, I'm not necessarily an idiot with regard to finances and economic matters. I look at it from a number of perspectives, and the one that disturbs me most, of course, is a historical one, and that says that the empires of the past have all pretty much perished on overextension of their empire and military power to support that overextension, which, of course, consumed the treasury, and on what a very famous Scott writer once said was democracy has a real problem in the fact that once you teach your people that they can attack the treasury with abandon, they will do so until the treasury is empty. So
right.
We've got both sides of these problems that we've given institutional fabric to in America. The one that scares me the most, though, is the one I know the most about, and that's the national security state that you just elaborated on. I see it providing, since 1945, the public good called security to a number of countries, not least of which were the North Atlantic Treaty countries, Germany, France, England, and so forth, Germany now anyway, but really Germany all along in its West German form, Japan, Korea, other countries of lesser weight, if you will, New Zealand, Australia, even Indonesia, Southeast Asian nations have benefited from it, even Vietnam since the close of the war. This is a public good that the United States has provided, and that public good at the very peak, of course, is a nuclear umbrella. And in the consequence of doing this and spending the amount of money in order to carry this out, we have not only shorted our own infrastructure and our own domestic environment in every field virtually, from education to water, we have also incurred this enormous debt that such an enterprise like this would require in order to continue it over time. So now we're looking at interest payments on the debt equaling the defense budget. And that's with the low interest rates right now, which I don't for a moment think aren't going to start going up. And when they go up, the interest payments annually on the debt are going to be bigger than the defense budget, and many projections now, including CBO, show about 2027, 2030, somewhere in there. There may not be any discretionary money left in the federal budget. It'll all be consumed. Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, the defense budget, so forth, all fixed costs. You can forget about the 20-plus trillion-dollar debt, but it's very difficult to forget about those interest payments every year. So the national security state has aided and abetted in a very formidable way the, I think, untenable economic situation we're in right now. And in a very profound way, I think that worries me as much as bad leadership in the current White House and so forth.
Well, I think I sent it to you. I just published a big overview on the pension funds. And if you step back and you look at the economics at a very high level, what you realize is the pension funds are the biggest buyers of treasury and have been for a long time. And essentially that money is going into the government. The government has refused to obey the financial laws related to how it manages its money. There's $21 trillion of undocumentable adjustments, you know, money literally missing from DOD and HUD. It's about $20 trillion from DOD. So the undocumentable adjustments are now bigger than the debt. And so if you step back and look at it from the point of view of a pension fund trustee, you're buying treasuries. That money is going into the federal government, but it's not being managed according to the law. Some of it may, even a great amount of it, may be disappearing, which means it's not on the balance sheet to pay back the debt you've put in. And the only thing you get back for that is a liability, an IOU from a group of taxpayers, many of whom include your beneficiaries. And so it's a double whammy. You know, the U.S. government has become a money laundering device to steal your savings.
And as I said, I'm a novice in this, but what I see us doing periodically in order to camouflage a lot of what you just described is printing billions of dollars, which it just doesn't make sense when the only thing behind those dollars is military power, which we've talked a little bit about, and perhaps the fact the Saudis still denominate oil sales in dollars. That could change at any moment.
Well, here's the thing. It's what you described. We printed dollars and people took dollars. One reason was because we were providing that umbrella. If instead of providing that umbrella, we have Donald Trump running around the world, you know, convincing everybody they're on their own and they have to build their own arsenal, why will they take our dollars? Well, they'll only take our dollars if we have sufficient force, but it looks to me like we can't spend fast enough. You know, if the Japanese are going to get, you know, take us on in terms of arms sales, I don't see how the economic model works.
I don't either. And I don't see how, even more profoundly for me, I don't see how the world absorbs without great potential for conflict all these armaments. Russia and us together now, the last figures I saw, we led Russia, but we were approaching $150 billion total. Between the two of us, and looking towards $200 billion with all this high-tech missile defense and everything. Incidentally, most of this missile defense, some $100 billion price tag so far for us, is probably not going to work. That's one of the most farcical things about this. Bill Perry once told me, Clinton's middle Secretary of Defense, the only engineer ever to be Secretary of Defense, that, Larry, we've never achieved more than 0.2. That means that when 10 missiles are coming in, we're going to get two of them. The other eight are going to hit. If they have nuclear warheads, we haven't accomplished much.
Right. What we've done is we've created globally an edifice or an infrastructure that makes money from almost having a war but not having a war. And I don't see how you maintain an almost having a war on a perpetual basis with high media excitement. I call it the shriekometer. Without having an accident. See,
I couldn't agree with you more. And I will tell you that some of the most profoundly disturbing conversation I heard in 2002 and 2003 in the Pentagon and elsewhere was people like John Bolton talking seriously about how good it would be and how cleansing it would be to have such a war. And I'm talking about a global war.
Right.
Steve Bannon type stuff, you know, let's break it all. And pick up the pieces afterward.
Right. Well, I hate to say this, but with the group, with the neocon group that I worked with in the Bush administration, I literally, it was like they had a literal need to destroy something, and then they would be satiated for a while, and then you could, the desire would build, and then they'd look for somebody else to destroy or something else they could break, and it was almost a demonic impulse. And my job became to just protect the career. You had the really excellent career people who were getting the work done, and they just kept wanting, hunting them and wanting to destroy them. It was a very, I hate to say it, was very demonic, and they just needed to be destroying people and things.
I think you've just described some of the philosophical underpinnings of many of the so-called neoconservatives that I met and worked with.
Right. I always recommend Charlie Ferguson's documentary on Iraq, and you were interviewed for that about, sort of this group going into Iraq and doing everything they could to destroy the civil infrastructure of the country on the theory that then they could bring in their pals as contractors and have big contracts, and how completely insane the whole thing was, and thoroughly destructive and wildly expensive. And all you ended up doing was pouring a lot more money into big corporate contractors that then have a dysfunctional infrastructure that then needs more contracts and more wars.
And no one more exemplified that than Halliburton, whose total figures on Iraq and Afghanistan that I saw the other day, I think ending in 2014 for Afghanistan, was $40 billion in profit.
Right. Well, it was interesting. One radio show called me when the Iraq war started, and they were interested in asking me about Iraq. So I just did a couple numbers, and I realized, looking at Halliburton's stock market, if the war hadn't happened, their stock would be basically, 100% of their stock market value was coming from the amount of money that they were generating from that war. They were quite dependent on the whole affair.
Lockheed Martin, probably the largest defense contractor in the world, falls in that same boat.
Oh, I don't know if you know that. When I was at HUD, Lockheed Martin ran the payment systems, and under the law, I, as Assistant Secretary of Housing, was responsible in the single family fund. I was required by law to run it on a self-supporting basis, and to do that, I needed the data on what was going on at the time. By the time I left, we had financial statements, but when I got there, we didn't. And so they controlled the payment systems and the information systems, and I needed the data to know how we were doing, and they refused to give it to me.
One of the things people don't know is that Lockheed Martin is the number one defense contractor for the Pentagon, but it's also number two, number three, number four for half the cabinet.
Well, I don't know if you know this. They ran the main, from what I can tell, they ran the main payment and information systems that the $21 trillion went missing over. And at the end of 2015, the biggest year of undocumentable adjustments was 2015. It was 6.5 trillion in 1 year, which is a dazzling number. And right after that, but before the financials were announced, Lockheed Martin spun their information, government contracting division off to a new company that SAIC had done the same thing with. And I said, oh, they're trying to get their liability off the balance sheet. It's a cut and run. So yeah, no, I know they're a piece of work. And what most people do, I call it the data beast, is that you've got the big defense contractors running the information and payment systems for all the government agencies. And
True.
my
And
real concern is,
as I understand it, Lockheed Martin also was the principal contractor responsible for the census when, what was it, 2013, 2014,
yes.
whatever.
Yeah.
That's
Yeah,
kind of
you.
astonishing if you think about that.
Well, that's why I call them. I've got a lot of things on the database, but what I just found is you had Lockheed Martin sucking up all the data from the government, the whole operation. And it was pretty frightening what was going on. Okay, so what do we do? The question comes down to you and me. We are watching a society literally go insane, whether it's insane financially or economic. This can't go to any good place, or having a nuclear war worldwide. What do we do?
I've been telling people all across the country, depending on the demographics of my audience, if it's older people, I know they vote, and so when they ask me that question, and they do almost inevitably in every Q&A for every talk I've given, from Notre Dame to Stanford to the University of Wisconsin to San Angelo in Texas, I mean, they ask me the question. I say, if you're like I see out there right now, I know you vote. A lot of gray hair out there, a lot of hair like mine. You vote. Go vote and vote every son of a bitch out of the Congress until you get someone who feels more about the country than he does his own political power, than she does about her own position in the Congress. Vote them out. If it's a young audience, I look at them and I say, we have screwed, we being me, my generation, and the one before and after, we have screwed the pooch. We have messed this country up. We're leaving you with more debt on your shoulders than probably any human civilization in history has ever been left with. You are going to have to fix it. Right now, set your cap, because you're going to have to fix it. You're going to go into the
Right.
CIA, the NSA, the federal government, whatever. You're going to have to fix it. I don't know any other way to look at it, because ultimately the answer is the American people. And if the American people don't step up to the task, then they deserve what they get.
Well, but here's the thing. The American people, in my experience, are exhausted. They've been struggling for years with expenses that are rising at a much faster rate than official inflation and stagnating or falling income, and trying to make things work. And if you look at sort of the predatory targeting that they're subject to, and the incredible deterioration in all the things that make up their physical health, it's extraordinary. So
I do find in both demographics, the older people to whom I talk about 40% of the time, and the younger people, the other 60%, I find positive stories. And I'll give you one from Penn State a couple of days ago. Young man in the back of the room who had sat there rather quiescent until the moment he raised his hand, he said essentially what you just asked me. He said, Professor, what do we do given the dismal scene you've just painted for us? And I said, well, what do you think should be done? And let me tell you a story. And I told him about Colin Powell as a lieutenant driving on his first trip in uniform from roughly around the Boston area down to Fort Benning, Georgia, and packing lots of chicken in the trunk of his car because he could not stop anywhere along the way without embarrassing himself greatly by going to the back door for colored people in order to get something to eat, let alone stay anywhere. And I said, that's no longer the case. He became the most powerful military man in the country and later the first cabinet officer, the Secretary of State. So we can improve. We can, if we stay at it, if we drive forward, we can bring the myth more into reality. And this young man said, I was hoping you would say that. By God, that's the way I feel. And I said, you can join my army any day then, young man. And he said, I'll sign up tomorrow. I find that spirit all across the country, and I'm encouraged by it. In fact, it's the only reason I keep teaching and the only reason I feel any optimism at all.
Well, that's certainly what I see when what I'm dealing with in terms of the Salieri report is 5 to 10% of the population that really cares and wants to do something and understands that part of this is going to have to be consciousness and cultural. We're all going to have to lead. So the notion of making America great again, I think, was very inspiring for many people in the heartland. And frankly, if you look at what was coming down in terms of the social engineering, just having that end was an enormous, or almost end, was an enormous relief for many people in the heartland. So, I think the fear of what was coming from a Clinton administration is at least stopped. Because I will tell you, I don't know if you heard this story. I was coming back from Denver in October 2016, and I stopped at a Flying J truck stop to go to the bathroom. And I walked into, the truck stops have these huge bathroom complexes, and I was very tired. I walked in and I looked at one, and it had the sign for both a man and a woman. And I was very confused. And then I looked at the other, and it was just women, and I realized, oh my God, this is the transgender bathroom thing. And now the truckers don't even have a men's room they can use. This is how Flying J has reconciled the tension. So the only option to go to the bathroom of the men is a co-ed thing. And I hate to say this, you know, I'm not a very sentimental person, as you probably realize. I started to cry. I just thought it was the
Nope.
biggest insult to the truckers that there
I
was.
don't blame you.
I thought,
I
how
don't
could a
blame
country
you.
do this?
I was just reading this really fine expose, I guess you'd call it, not maybe not, just sort of documentary in narrative form in National Geographic about the historically black colleges and universities and how what had been a very declining student population, even to the point of causing some of these colleges that were historical, Fisk and Howard and others, to contemplate disappearing in the future. And now it's all reversed. It's all reversed. It's up 109% in the Clark Atlanta University complex, Spelman and Morehouse and so forth in the Atlanta area. It's up 40 to 50% in all the other
Wow.
historically black. Yeah. And so I'm thinking, well, this is very positive. And then I read it and I think about what sort of thing you were just thinking about. This is adding to the division in this country. It may be positive for black Americans. That's great. It's terrific. They're maintaining their culture and they're keeping. But when you read the comments of the young people and you read the comments of the faculty and the staff and everything, yes, we should know our history. Yes, we should know where the myth is tainted, as it were. Yes, we should know that 4,400 people were lynched in the South. And that they were lynched under very despicable circumstances. How could we even call ourselves a democracy, let alone care about human rights? Yes, these things are important, but they're also extremely divisive if the
Right.
educational process is not handled properly. And I see us handling it abysmally. What we're doing is
Right.
going into Me Too and Black Lives Matter and so forth and so on, and we're creating these divisions that are going to lead us to blood in the streets, I'm afraid.
Well, I just see incredible effort top down trying to do divide and conquer. And I came to
Yes.
the conclusion that if you could heal the divide, the male-female divide and conquer, you could heal the rest of them. But it's interesting. One of the things I learned as an investment advisor is that oftentimes my initial clients were couples coming to me where the men and women were just fighting abysmally because the women would see what was going on in the economy that was harmful to human and intellectual capital, but they didn't understand finance. And so what I discovered was that it was very easy to trick a woman and it was very easy to trick a man, but it was almost impossible to trick them if they were working together. And so it became
Yes.
my job to simply teach terminology back and forth until they could start to understand and hear each other and work together, and then they were off to the races. And I think it's the same thing with us. We're very easy to divide and conquer, and that's one of the things that's going to have to get beat. The people who lead through, because I think leadership is just going to be, have to come bottom up, and it's going to be the kids like the one you just described. And I see leaders all over the country. They just finally had to realize it was nuts enough that they had to realize, oh, you know, I'm the leader. I can't wait for anybody. It doesn't mean I don't vote and don't care, but I see a lot more willingness to take responsibility, including at the state and local level, and I think that's positive.
To support your previous anecdotal information, and I read this longitudinal survey that was just so fascinating. When women approach 20 to 30% of the composition in a decision-making environment, they're very subdued, they're usually quiet, and men harass the hell out of them. This was a particularly vivid study of our Senate and our House of Representatives. But when women approach 50% and higher, the decisions are a hell of a lot better. And the outcomes are better.
That was my experience in business. And you know, it was funny because I used to always have to be a dictator. The men always wanted to work with the men, and the women always had to work with the women. And I used to have to force them to work together, but we would always get better economic results when there was a balance. And I also wanted to just inform you that I'm going to be road tripping with Amy Benjamin when I'm in Down Under, and I'll be in New Zealand in May. And she and I are going to go road tripping thanks to you and your introduction to me of her article.
Oh, terrific. Terrific. I'm glad to hear
Yeah.
that.
Yeah, I want to thank you. Okay, well, if there's anything we can do, just keep doing what you're doing. You're doing a great job. It's a lot easier to understand the world when we can log in and listen to Lawrence Wilkerson.
Well, I really
Describe.
enjoy reading your material too.
Well, I don't know how you do it, but you seem to be healthy and well and speaking everywhere. And so it just goes to tell you, just goes to show you can tell the truth and stay alive. You're the proof. So we wish you well and thank you for joining us on the Solari Report.
Take care and thank you for having me.